short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As a playwright, William Shakespeare was especially attuned to the power of language. It's how his characters woo their would-be lovers, plot conspiracies, and reflect on the human condition. But Shakespeare's words also speak to power. Whether it's an English king, a Danish prince, or a Roman noble, Shakespeare's rulers use words to take power, maintain control, convince allies, belittle enemies, and sway their subjects. Take, for example, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. In this scene from Act 3, Caesar is dead, stabbed by a conspiracy of Roman nobles. A mob of Roman citizens gather to celebrate Caesar's death, calling him a tyrant. Caesar's friend, Mark Antony, confronts them. Antony, played here in this 1970s film by Charlton Heston, calls Caesar's assassins, including Brutus, honorable men. But slowly, Antony turns the crowd, urging them to see Caesar's death as a crime to be avenged.
I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator, as Brutus is, for I have neither wit, nor words, nor power of speech to stir men's blood. Show you sweet Caesar's wounds, and bid them speak for me. But were I Brutus, and Brutus Antony, ere were an Antony would ruffle up your spirits, and put a tongue in every wound of Caesar's that should move the stones of Rome to rise and mutiny!
A bombastic orator rallying a crowd to action, a carefully crafted appeal to emotions like fear and anger. These are the things of Shakespeare and of politics. And that's what we're discussing today. What insight can be gained about our present politics from the works of William Shakespeare? What themes and characters from his works do we see playing out today? How are our politics different and how are they similar? And is it tragedy or comedy? Or is it all a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing? Here to talk Shakespeare and what he has to say about our current political moment in 2018 are two people who've been thinking about this a lot for some current events and performances at Dartmouth College. Tom Luxon is a Dartmouth English professor who teaches Shakespeare and is involved in bringing a modern-day staging of Shakespeare's tragedy Coriolanus to the Hopkins Center for the Arts this month. And Charlie Whelan, a lecturer and policy fellow at Dartmouth's Rockefeller Center, who's looking at how politicians from Henry V to Donald Trump shape their public personas. Charlie Whelan, Tom Luxon, welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you.
Good to be with you.
Thanks, Jane.
So why should we connect Shakespeare and our current political climate? What's the connection? Tom, I'll start with you.
Well, yeah, Shakespeare's age was an age of rapid change. In the generation before he was born, everybody was Roman Catholic. And then all of a sudden, they were Protestant. And then they were Roman Catholic again. And then they were Protestant again. It was a major change in politics because religion went with politics. And today, we're in rapid change. Some of it's about religion. A lot of it's about politics. And a lot of it's about attitudes towards public and what the public thinks.
Charlie, you want to chime in?
The remarkable thing about Shakespeare is that he intuited almost 500 years ago what social scientists have spent five centuries trying to catch up with, which is that language dictate emotions, that emotions drive politics, and that effective leaders know all of this and are extremely versed in manipulating it to their own benefit.
Charlie, you gave a talk earlier this week called Tweeting to the Populace, Roman Mobs and Modern Media. What was your premise?
The major premise is that political leaders have always used whatever the media tools were at the time to try and sway public opinion. If you go back to when we were debating the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, of course, were meant to persuade. The various factions had their own newspapers. They were, by the way, quite nasty and partisan, often anonymous. If you fast forward fairly far, you get to FDR using radio to remarkable effect during the Great Depression and preparing the country for war. You speed to the next tectonic change, which is television. Many listeners know that those who listened on the radio to the Kennedy-Nixon debates thought that Nixon won. Those who watched Kennedy on TV thought that he won. So you have this major change in the medium. Barack Obama was arguably the first to use social media, email, text, and the like. And of course, that brings us right up to President Donald Trump, who is using Twitter. So the commonality there is that you're always trying to move people. What is changing, as Tom said, at a rapid clip, is the tools that we can use to do so.
You know, Shakespeare was political, but I'm hoping that you can remind those of us who either barely remember, half read, maybe never read our high school Shakespeare, about some of the politics in Shakespeare's work, some of what he was occupied by and preoccupied by in his own writing. Tom Luxon?
Yeah, sure. But before I answer that question, yeah. I just want to tell our listeners that the performance of Coriolanus brought here from the Stratford, Ontario Festival will be on November 30th. So it's not this month, but November 30th, Saturday, December 1st, and Sunday, December 2nd.
You know, actually, when I said that, I was thinking that we were in November, perhaps wishful thinking.
It just feels like November out there.
It feels like it does indeed.
Yes, yeah, next month.
Politics in Shakespeare's day. Well, you know, we could get pretty specific here to the issues of this play on two levels. First, Shakespeare's play begins by depicting the Roman plebeians, the common people, the working people, rioting. And they're rioting about food. They're starving. And they're charging the patricians with hoarding grain. This play was written in 1608, 1609, somewhere in one of those 2 years. But in 1607, there were food riots in Stratford, Warwickshire, where Shakespeare was a major landowner, and he probably hoarded grain too. So we're not sure whether this play comes down on the side of the grain-hoarding patricians or the hungry plebeians. It's, as all Shakespeare's plays are very ambivalent about these kinds of things.
And patricians being the sort of bourgeoisie and the plebeians being the lower class people?
Is that, no.
Who are we talking about here?
Jane, there was no bourgeoisie in Rome. At least that's what the evidence seems, that there were the very rich 52 families who ran Rome, and then there was everybody else.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And so there's no middle ground. That's why we talk about
no middle class, right?
No middle class. So when we talk about, you know, the disappearance of the middle class, we could be looking back to 5th century BCE Rome when there was no such thing as middle class. It was just the rulers and the ruled. And as Rome is, you know, Shakespeare represents Rome as trying to imagine something called a republic, because they were moving from having been a monarchy to being a republic, from concentrated absolute rule to distributed power. And what role should the people have in that was the big question. This is also a question in Shakespeare's day. The new king, King James, he argued for absolutist divine right rule and tried to rule without parliament. His son ruled without parliament, and it led to civil war. So the issue, you know, Shakespeare's interested in looking at the Republic of Rome, or what he knew about it, and because they're the same questions are at issue. What are the rulers' attitudes to their people? Should they starve? The hero of this play calls the people geese, sheep, hares, mechanics, minnows, slaves, my favorite is fragments, and the many-headed monster. He has no good words for the people.
And you see a connection there?
I see a weird connection. This hero, one of the things I like about Coriolanus, even though he's a thoroughly obnoxious character, is he always says exactly what he thinks. And he tries to have good words for the people because he needs their voice to become consul, but he can't bring himself to do it. He just hates them so much and ends up being banished from Rome because of it. I mean, we have a leader today who has a sort of a fraudulent populism, and we think he's saying exactly what he thinks, and we think he's a friend of the people. So in some ways, he's a skewed version. He does say apparently what he thinks, but we're not exactly sure what he's thinking. At least Coriolanus was absolutely consistent. He hated the people.
You know, Charlie Whelan, Tom was talking about some of the phrases, the words used and the insults. And, you know, one that springs to mind, not from President Trump, but from Hillary Clinton, is when she used that phrase basket of deplorables and calling Trump supporters deplorables, and how, you know, she unleashed that word, but then it wound up being weaponized against her. And, you know, there's a word that could come right out of a Shakespeare play, it seems.
We have learned over the last 40 or 50 years exactly how powerful language is. And I think if people tune into the way that politicians and marketers and other people use very specific language to certain effect, then something like deplorables isn't quite so surprising in how we responded to it. So, for example, there are Republican pollsters who rebranded global warming as climate change because it seemed more benign. Obviously, neither side speaks about abortion. They talk about pro-choice or pro-life. Why? Because they want to emphasize the choice piece or the life piece. The folks who organize around gambling don't call themselves the gambling industry. They call themselves the gaming industry. It sounds a lot more fun than gambling. Our public life is driven by these very refined uses of language that, again, Shakespeare had the pulse of long before we started doing focus groups and the like.
Immigration, another one where you can
immigration
certainly
is a perfect one. We can, if we were to talk about immigration, the first thing, if Tom and I were to have a discussion, is, all right, what are we going to use to describe the people moving towards the border? Are we going to call them illegal aliens, in which case they're against the law and they're from away and they're hostile? Or are we going to call them undocumented workers? Undocumented suggests, well, you didn't fill out the forms. Nobody likes the paperwork. Work is a very powerful and positive image in the United States. So undocumented workers and illegal aliens might describe the same population, but they are very loaded terms. And it's hard even to find a neutral term. So most of the issues that we care about, if you think about it consciously, the language is the first division.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. I hear you thinking you want to chime in here.
You can hear me think?
I can hear you breathing. It's a secret power.
Well, I have the word deplorables written on my little notes here, so I'm glad you brought that up. But I want to chime in on what Charlie's saying here. Let's remember that illegal aliens is the least obnoxious term that's been used for – they're now being called invaders, rapists, really bad people, I think is one of the phrases. So Charlie's absolutely right. The politics is in the naming. And if you can get – if you can attach these names and if you can put these words in the mouths of the people – and have them using these words, it's extremely powerful. And also, if you can convince the people, as Mark Antony tries to convince the people and succeeds, if you can convince the people that you have no art, you're just being absolutely sincere, that you have no interest in manipulating their attitudes, and then succeed in manipulating their attitudes against their own interests, then you can really succeed in moving a political agenda. Coriolanus does – Coriolanus refuses to do that, but there is a character in the play. His name is Menenius Agrippa, and he pretends to be a friend of the people, and he's a senator, so he's a noble patrician, and he's pretending to be a friend of the people, but he's off mic for half the play. And or no, he's accidentally on mic for half the play. Sorry to put it that way. And so we hear him say things he doesn't want the public to hear all through the play.
Boy, that sounds familiar too throughout American politics over the last quarter century.
It really does. And he's one of the people, along with Coriolanus' mother of all people, who are trying to get Coriolanus into the consulship by pandering to the people, at least for the moment.
You know, and there are so many political examples of a candidate or an office holder being manipulated in a way that suggests they are closer to the people. So you have George H.W. Bush eating pork rinds, although he may have actually enjoyed them, trying to keep him off camera when he was in that big speedboat or playing golf or doing those kinds of things. You have Lamar Alexander, people who on the New Hampshire side will remember, you know, he shows up in the flannel shirt because that's what a man of the people wears and so on. And as Tom would suggest, a lot of times these things fall completely flat because people can see through them and are quite resistant to being manipulated that in that way. On the other hand, Donald Trump, who's a person of New York, very, very rich, somehow seems to have connected with people who on the surface have absolutely nothing in common with him.
Let's go right to some calls. Tom is calling in from Williamsville. Hi, Tom. What's your thought?
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
Yeah. Well, we were lucky enough at the recently concluded Brattleboro Literary Festival to have Stephen Greenblatt speak. And he was reading from his new book, which is right to the point, Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics. And I can't recommend it enough. It's right about 200 pages. He manages to skewer a certainly very stable genius of a politician and without ever once mentioning his name. So I won't either, but can't recommend it enough.
Tom, you're not alone. Ray wrote in to say there's a book, Tyrant, Shakespeare in Politics by Stephen Greenblatt. He wrote, among other things, the well-regarded Will in the World, which examines what Shakespeare wrote and said on leaders, politics, and power. Charlie and Tom, you must be familiar with this book as well.
Just finished reading it today.
Ooh, and what do you think?
It's a wonderful book. It's not pitched to your listeners will be pleased to hear that it's not pitched to professional Shakespeareans. It's pitched to a public, and so it's and yet it does exactly what Tom said. It's almost a Shakespearean tour de force to make your point about a person without ever mentioning his name. It's almost as good as Mark Anthony.
Meredith is on the line with us from Cambridge. Hey, Meredith, go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
So I wanted to talk about Iago in Othello, who is the master manipulator. And, you know, he is able to prey on the weakness of Othello. And without any evidence, Othello begins to believe something that is not true. And it's hard to ignore that happening in our current political climate. And it's the, you know, separating people we're supposed to trust, leading to divisiveness and ultimately wrecking everything. So,
Yeah. Meredith, thanks for bringing that other play into the mix. Tom, what do you think?
Well, Meredith, thank you for bringing that up because Shakespeare is interested in gender politics to a very wide degree. This fear of women is really what it's about. You know, you don't need evidence. Othello doesn't need any evidence of his wife's infidelity. Everybody the ideological discourse is that women cannot be faithful. So if she's a woman and she's your wife, and if you also have poor self-image, as Othello certainly does, why did she marry me? Then you don't need evidence. And this play, Coriolanus, is also a play that's very interested in how people react to very, very powerful women. The most powerful woman in probably all of Shakespeare's plays is Volumnia, Coriolanus' mother. Volumnia says to Coriolanus, "You sucked your valor from my breasts. Oof. I made you the warrior you are." And she also is responsible for convincing himself to turn into a weak little boy at the end of the play. So – and I just want to mention a play that I was teaching in class this week, Measure for Measure. In that play, a woman who's about to become a nun is assaulted by a man who's about to become a judge. And she says, "I will proclaim you." And his response is, "No one will believe you." And the student, the contemporary applications of this were not lost on the students. So play after play after play is concerned with the fears that people have of mannish women, women who are outside of the bounds of the roles prescribed. And of course, there was a mannish woman who was Queen of England during Shakespeare's, most of Shakespeare's life, Elizabeth I.
I should point out, you know, because this is the humble brag, the beginning and the end of my career as a thespian was playing Mariana in Measure for Measure in high school. So, you know, I would count myself an expert there on
yes.
that play.
You know, one of the striking things about so many of these plays is that you can set them in the present, keeping the original language, and that they're as powerful as they've ever been. Coriolanus, the characters are texting and you see the text on stage. I've seen Henry III performed in a modern context. And that is testimony to the fact that Shakespeare captures these base emotions, envy, jealousy, vanity, that have been overlooked. And I will say, as somebody coming from the economics profession, when we neglect those emotions, we almost always get it wrong.
Pat in Rutland wrote in to say, please tell us how we can undo the takeover of half of our population by fake news. In a divided media age where folks can tune out dissenting views, did the Bard address this? And, you know, I'm not sure which half of the population Pat is speaking to, but, you know, it's maybe a lot of the population is getting fake news from one side or another. Charlie, do you think there's anything that we can learn from Shakespeare about that?
I think Tom and I would agree that the liberal arts are as important as they've ever been. The essence of fake news is not trying to correct the news sources or to censor them. The essence of dealing with the fake news problem is on the listener side, which is how do we train people to be discerning consumers of news? That's why we teach Shakespeare. That's why we teach basic analysis and logic. And that if we go after this as a communications news problem, we're going to miss the fact that it is an informed consumer problem. So I would say we ought to be teaching Shakespeare, maybe not how we teach it in high school where you read these plays without appreciating that they're supposed to be performed. But the reason we should be teaching these kinds of holistic things is to circle right back to where this caller pointed out. We need informed people in the broadest sense of the word.
And you really think, Charlie, reading Shakespeare, having people, young people, high school and college people read or sort of, you know, do a performed reading of Shakespeare is going to help with the fake news cycle we're in this digital age?
Well, not just – I don't think if you go out and give everybody a Shakespeare class, the problem goes away. But
right.
It is part of a canon that allows you to understand more deeply people's motivations, people's willingness to distort things for their own good, and understanding, as we've already discussed, how language can be used to motivate emotions, that it's part of a more complete understanding of human nature. And that is at the heart of our willingness to embrace fake news, often just because it suits our own purposes.
Tom?
Well, I also think not just reading Shakespeare in a college classroom, but going to plays is because people who are producing Shakespeare today are always looking for contemporary presentist hooks, not just because they for cynical reasons, but because they're interested in using the plays to understand and then re-understand our current culture. And this production of Coriolanus, I saw it up in Stratford, and when you first start watching it, you're not sure whether you're watching a movie, a television show, an online video, or a play. And it gradually dawns on you that those really are real actors there, but they're lit and they're mic'd in such a way so that it looks sometimes like it's TV, sometimes like it's widescreen video, sometimes like it's on your laptop. And at the end of Act 3, when Coriolanus is banished by the Roman tribunes, he steps out of the frame onto a stage and he says, "I banish you," and something like, "there must be worlds elsewhere." And I think what this production is trying to do is trying to suggest to us that too much of our reality, too much of what counts as our reality is on screens. And we need to step out of our screens for a moment and banish that reality for a moment. Shakespeare's theater, the Playhouse, when you went to the Playhouse, boys were playing women, men were playing women, commoners were playing kings, and the violence was really fake. It was all – no one was fooled. You went to hear the plays and to see the action, but nobody was being fooled. Today, our media is out to fool us, sometimes for good and sometimes for ill.
And I would say some of our media is out to fool us.
Yes.
I would take umbrage at the idea that I'm out to fool you.
No, you're not, Jane. But also I want to bring up the thing that Charlie started with at the beginning, language. Every play of Shakespeare reminds us just how fragile language is. And our laws are based on language. And if language is fragile, our laws are fragile. Our Constitution is fragile. It's not obvious what words mean. And they change meaning. That's obvious as soon as you give students an old spelling version of Shakespeare. They say, wow, our language has changed so much. And that is a really important thing for students, for everybody to understand. Our language is not stable. And if our language isn't stable, the laws aren't stable, culture's not stable, everything could be changed.
And let me add that the reason we know this language is so powerful, we always had reason to believe that it was powerful. But now that we can stick people in machines and watch their brains operate and so on, is that some language operates on an emotional level. So it actually activates a different part of the brain. We know, for example, that fear is a far more powerful motivator than other emotions. That's why when you turn on your political commercials during this time of year, they're so awful. They're ominous. You know, this person is going to raise your taxes, because that will activate the part of our brain associated with fear, and that's likely to get you to act. So in some ways, as I said earlier, the social sciences are just catching up with what Shakespeare knew, which is that language activates these emotions, and those in turn have profound political effects.
In the Flood Zone writes, rhetoric as an art was mandatory training in classical studies, which was a necessity for any leader right into the 20th century. Great lawyers, as well as great leaders, propagandists, preachers, and demagogues studied the art of public address. The entire objective was to sway the audience to one side. The examples through history are innumerable. This is why we must teach critical thinking, rhetoric, and healthy skepticism starting in high school. And let's go to Art, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Art. Go right ahead.
Well, hi there. This is a great show. So much truth being spoken. I am old enough to have attended an off-Broadway production back in the 60s called McBird, which was a very pointed takedown of Lyndon Johnson's presidency using the Macbeth play. And it was very controversial at the time and stirred a lot of people up. But it was a beautiful example to me of how, you know, what's all being said today is true over a long spectrum of history, that the various stories that Shakespeare has given us, the patina of whatever current ridiculousness is happening, can be placed on one or another in myriad ways. So anyway, I'll go, but thank you for this.
All right, thank you. I haven't seen McBird. Charlie or Tom, have you? Did you?
No, but I'm making it up in my brain right now. It's all about Lady Bird, of course. And again, the fear of the woman dominating the man. So that's what Macbeth is about, of course. I don't know if that's what McBird was about, but I'll bet it was.
But, you know, if I could push a button and get Shakespeare to come out and write plays about contemporary situations, I'm the literal policy type. So you have this standoff or confrontation between McNamara and LBJ, where McNamara has finally decided that he's got grave doubts about the way the war is being executed. It can't be won. In his mind, although I don't know if we found the memo, he's written this memo expressing these doubts to LBJ. So that's a Shakespearean confrontation between the underling with grave doubts and the leader perpetrating this war in Vietnam. And McNamara is unable to persuade him. I mean, that to me seems like something right out of a Shakespeare play, where in that case, the language was unable to persuade the leader of something that I think most people believe he should have done differently.
You know, it seems in some ways sometimes like, oh, anything could be seen as just like a Shakespeare play. Like, oh, that's just like Shakespeare. Anything with drama, you know, we sometimes say like, oh, you know, it's Shakespearean. What is the sort of purpose and value of laying these ideas and these preoccupations of Shakespeare onto our modern world as you're doing, you know, as obviously we're doing today? So not to make you tell me why it's a good idea for us to do this show, but like, what's the value to people to be thinking specifically about Shakespeare, not just about rhetoric, not just about critical thinking, but specifically about the works of Shakespeare and connecting it to our modern era?
So let me start as the Shakespeare amateur, and then we can go to the pro. But to my mind, the genius of Shakespeare is these complicated characters that are not all good or all bad, the classic Shakespearean flaw, where in the case of LBJ, lots of good happens, but whether it's hubris or his blindness or what have you, he blunders into a certain situation. Whether it's Bill Clinton with his known foibles, but really a brilliant retail politician. So part of my reason for using, perhaps overusing that kind of Shakespearean character is it's redolent of these characters that have so much good about them, but then that flaw lurking there that turns out to have profound consequences.
One thing I want to say is kind of an obvious. What's valuable about Shakespeare for thinking about contemporary politics and contemporary social problems? And one is it's a play. And plays don't have narrators. They don't have a good – well, some plays do, but most plays don't have narrators. They don't have an authorial voice running through them telling you what to think. And this is particularly true of Shakespeare's plays. Sometimes I think of Shakespeare's plays as a practice in casuistry, setting cases, setting up equivalences, setting up philosophical problems and asking the people there to do a number of things in response. One is figure out what you think about that case. Another one is laugh at it. And also I think reading Shakespeare in particular, it brings an historical view. We've been there before. That's really good to see in thinking through problems.
It's really interesting to think about all of this and always to think back into the canon and into literature and into past history, which, of course, is what William Shakespeare, you know, was writing about his contemporary times and about the ideas, the gender politics, the politics of the time. So always interesting to think about it and really interesting to hear the two of you help us think critically about Shakespeare and our modern era. Charlie Whelan is a lecturer and policy fellow at Dartmouth's Rockefeller Center. He's also an author and former correspondent for The Economist. Tom Luxon is a Dartmouth English professor who teaches Shakespeare and is involved in bringing this modern-day staging of Shakespeare's tragedy Coriolanus to the Hopkins Center for the Arts next month, November, and into December. We have more information about all of the Shakespeare-centered events going on at Dartmouth on our website, vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition to find today's show page. Charlie and Tom, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, Jane. It's been really fun.